Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
The headline from the weekend was the passing of the bills for aid for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan. Other headlines over the weekend focused on whether or not Speaker of the House Mike Johnson would lose his job in the process. But beyond the headlines, the weekend may actually have galvanized a new governing coalition. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, after many months of delay and debate, the House of Representatives has passed a series of bills relating to foreign aid to some of our key allies. The bills covered military and humanitarian aid to Israel and Gaza, Ukraine, aid to Taiwan, the Indo-Pacific. The legislation will now go to the Senate, where tomorrow it has a chance to pass, and the president has indicated that he will sign it once it is passed. So the interesting thing is, what is the impact of all of this? Beyond the headlines of we can all exhale and say Congress did something, we can debate whether the something was a good something or a bad something. But the fact that they acted, I think, is important, and that's going to have ramifications both internationally with these aid packages, but domestically as well. And so as we look at how we go about that, I think a lot of the hand-wringing over the weekend was not so much whether or not these would pass, but how that would go and then what it would mean for Speaker Johnson and his ability to stay the Speaker of the House. So I want to break it down in a couple of different ways today. One, looking at this very interesting and new coalition that seems to be developing. And we often talk about the deep division in Washington. We talk about the polarization. We talk about the fake fights and the false choice that go on every day in our nation's capital. And interestingly, starting last week on Wednesday, when Speaker of the House Mike Johnson introduced these different packages of bills for aid for our allies, it was a very interesting moment where he said, "This is what I think is the right thing to do. And so I'm going to do it. And if it costs me my job, so be it." Now, after the legislation passed on Saturday, Speaker Johnson spoke to the press about the process that they had just gone through.
So this afternoon, the House acted. Instead of taking the path of least resistance and bringing up the Senate supplemental on the House floor, or just allowing a discharge petition to come forward, we gave our members a voice. We gave them a chance. We gave them a better process and ultimately a much better policy. Our process in the end ensured that each member was able to consider the individual supplemental elements on their own merits, which is exactly how the House is supposed to work.
So, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson speaking shortly after the bills were passed on Saturday and saying, look, this was about a process. And part of the reason Speaker Johnson divided up the bills that the Senate had passed in just one big bill was so that the members of the House that have different perspectives and different feelings about different aspects of it could have a better vote and a better process. In other words, if a member wanted to vote yes for aid to Ukraine, but no for aid to Israel, they were able to do that, as opposed to the previous process, which was it's all or nothing. And so many of the problems that we face in Washington, so much of the gridlock comes when we have these all or nothing bills. When you either have to vote for everything, the whole enchilada plus, or nothing. And sometimes that makes it difficult, and it's often hard for us watching to really be able to discern, well, why did my representative or why did my senator vote no on a particular bill? And it's easy to just skim across the headlines, as we often do, and say, oh, well, you know, they're not for this or they are for that. How could they cast that vote? But so often it's all of the things underneath that you have to get to understand, oh, now I understand why this particular senator or this particular representative voted a certain way. I think what the Speaker of the House has done is a good process because it allows the members to consider very specific things. I think it's the way the House is supposed to run, not thousands and thousands of pages of bills that nobody reads and nobody can understand, but then it's easier to vote no than it is to vote yes, and we end up with just gridlock. So by the numbers is really interesting, too. There's an interesting coalition that seems to be afoot in the House of Representatives. So on the votes over the weekend, in the vote on the Ukraine bill, you had 112 Republicans voted against it, but you had an overwhelming majority that voted for it. If you look at the Israel package, it was 366 to 58. The Taiwan and Indo-Pacific bill, 384 to 34. So really interesting. And I would actually say those numbers against those particular votes was actually probably smaller. But there are those in the House who are interesting voters. They'll make the hard vote when they have to, but if it looks like they aren't needed, they'll take the easy vote. So I think you had a few of those that took place as well. But this has also taken place on a number of other things, funding the government, dealing with the debt limit, where we've had these big overwhelming numbers, been able to get some of those things done. Now, I think the process needs to continue to be refined and improved. But I do think it was a moment where the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, actually became the Speaker of the House when he said, this is what I think needs to be done for the good of the country, in my view, and that's what I'm going to do. And if it costs me my job, so be it. Speaker Johnson reiterated something he's been saying since Wednesday of last week, and that is, I'm not going to walk around in a defensive crouch worried about someone filing a petition to vacate the chair. I'm going to do my job and let the chips fall where they may. We need more of that. In fact, you've heard me on this show many, many times. Ask people running for office or people in office, what would make all of this worth it? Even if you lost, or what would you do? What would you vote for? What bill would you put forward, even if you knew passing it would cost you your job in the end? And I think it's important for all of us as voters, if you ask that question to a candidate and they don't have an answer, you should think again about casting a vote for them. Because if they can't define what is most important, what would be worth it to them, even at the expense of their current elected position, then there's no chance. There's no chance they're going to be able to show any kind of political courage when it really matters and when it really counts. And so regardless of how you feel about the bills themselves, regardless of how you feel where Speaker Johnson fits on the political spectrum, he did a couple of things in this last week that we should all think again about. We often talk about where's the next statesman or stateswoman going to come from? Where's the next person who's going to be willing to tell their own conference that they're wrong? Who's the next person who's going to step up in difficult circumstances and make the difficult choice, even if it costs them their job? Those are things we should talk more about. And it's across the political spectrum. But we have to have people willing to go beyond the headlines and the clickbait and what's going to get them attention and what's actually going to help them do the work of the American people. And I think that happened over the weekend. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Get deeper insights on the news from Inside Sources.
Well, tonight when the sun sets, another Passover will begin. Passover has been described as the oldest and most transformative story of hope ever told. It tells of how an otherwise undistinguished group of slaves found their way to freedom from the greatest empire of their time. It tells the revolutionary story of how the supreme power intervened in history to liberate the supremely powerless. It is a story of the defeat of probability by the force of possibility. It defines what it is to be a Jew, a living symbol of hope. And as we move into Passover, really thrilled to have back on the program with us Rabbi Brad Hirschfield, co-founder and co-executive editor of the Wisdom Daily. Brad also serves as president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. It's a leadership training institute, think tank, and resource center based in New York City. And Rabbi Brad, welcome back to the show.
It's so good to be with you, Boyd. Thank you for having me.
Well, this is an interesting Passover season, obviously, with a lot of the challenges around the world, the uncertainty. Give us your sense rolling into Passover. What is it that not just those of the Jewish faith, but what should everyone be thinking about as we roll into Passover?
So I love that question because the message I would share today is not only for Jews, although this is a pretty challenging time for a lot of reasons, but lots of people have challenges. And for me, the thing I go back to, especially this year, is that in Jewish tradition, there are two models for Passover. The first Passover, the Passover of Egypt, and then every subsequent one. And the thing that is different about the Passover of Egypt is that it was celebrated while the Israelites were still in bondage. That's the amazing thing. So when you speak about the triumph of possibility over probability, that doesn't happen afterwards. It's that you dare to live as if it is possible, and that's actually when possibility can trump possibility. Because there they were, some 3,200 years ago, after hundreds of years in slavery, promised that they're going out the next morning. But let's be clear, Moses and Aaron had done some nifty tricks on behalf of God. But, you know, the Israelites had very short memories, as we know from Scripture. And yes, Pharaoh had said, I will let them go. But he had already lied about that three or four different times. And with all of that, gathered in their slaves' quarters, after hundreds of years of slavery, those ancient Israelites began to celebrate that they were going free tomorrow. Mm. Now, nothing in their lives, in their parents' lives, in their grandparents' lives, in their great-grandparents' lives, in their great-great-grandparents' lives, prepared them to believe this was possible. In fact, everything told them, no, we're going to wake up tomorrow and be slaves as we have been for hundreds of years. Mm. And yet they insisted that they believed they were going out tomorrow. And anyone who doesn't understand that it is the daring to believe it will happen, which is often the key ingredient in making it happen, that's what we need to remind ourselves. We need to use what, and this is not a political thing, whether you loved them or didn't, what President Obama dared to call the audacity of hope. And I would wish that everybody would live into the audacity of their greatest hopes with faith, with compassion, and with, to quote you, Boyd, the deep trust that possibility will triumph over probability.
I love that. And it's so powerful that whole idea of daring to live as if. Even before it happens. We often talk about it in the power of what a difference a day makes. And for those Israelites, so what a difference a day did make. But they had to.
It certainly did.
They had to believe first. And I want to go to this second type of Passover that you have been alluding to, and this whole idea of what can we do and how do we do that, and how do we do that with something that I think is one of your unique gifts, Rabbi Brad, and that is this passion for compassion in all settings, not just the ones that lean in our favor.
So I think, you know, every subsequent Passover was celebrated, and that meant in good times and in bad times. And so what we can always do is find meaning, find purpose, and dare to live our purpose, not naively. I get it. Naivete is, you know, dangerous, dangerous stuff. But being realistic doesn't preclude being optimistic. Mm. And when it does, that's when cynicism takes in. So what we can do is we can take stock of all the reasons we have not to dare to live as if. I get it. And then we can understand two things, that with all of that, we can still do it. Every one of us has that within us. And that part of living the as-ifness, part of living hopefully, part of living everything we want for ourselves is to be aware that there are probably people around us who want many of the same things. And we do not have to agree with them in any way, shape, or form to still find some measure of dignity in who they are, even as we profoundly disagree with them. In fact, I would tell you that is really what's at stake in a lot of the struggles that are going on right now in the United States about what's going on thousands of miles away in Israel and in Gaza. Mm. I actually don't believe you have to be on one side and then fail to appreciate the other. In fact, that's exactly what we can't do. Right? I admit it, proud to be a Zionist, proud of the state of Israel. No, it's not perfect. Yes, it is the Jewish homeland. And
And
for all of those reasons, I imagine that Palestinians want the same things that I want, which is a land to call their own.
Yeah.
And I get that. The fundamental difference is that when the need to have a land to call your own means extinguishing everyone who doesn't share your views, that's the opposite of hope. That, in fact, is the kind of cynicism which says it's all zero sum. And if it's not all going to be my way, then it should be nothing at all. And that's a struggle no one can afford to have.
Yeah. I'm going to go back to one of my favorite quotes from William George Jordan, Power of Truth, written back in 1902. And I think this is so apt as we enter into Passover. It says, when nature decides on anyone as a reformer, she whispers to him his great message. She places in his hand the staff of courage, wraps around him the robes of patience and self-reliance, and starts him on his way. Then, in order that he may have strength to live through it all, she mercifully calls him back for a moment and makes him an optimist. And I love that optimistic view, and I love some of the things that you have been pointing out in terms of we don't always get everything, but sometimes when we don't get everything, we don't do anything. We just hunker down or say, oh, it's impossible. And I think that was one of the things leading into Passover, that Moses clearly went with some very small incremental things at the beginning that ultimately led to the big thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I would challenge anyone to tell me a time when human beings took an all or nothing at all approach and it went well, even for their side.
Yeah.
Right, it just doesn't, and you're exactly right. You know, everyone knows various history, you know, biblical narratives, American narratives, let my people go. And boy, with so many people held captive still in Gaza, I don't think there's been a year, certainly in my lifetime, when that phrase, let my people go, has been more needed, more real, and frankly, more painful to say. And it will be hard to use those words tonight because they're not out. They are held hostage in Gaza. But that phrase, let my people go, begins when Moses goes, not once, not twice, but three times to Pharaoh, says, let my people go in the book of Exodus, in the biblical narrative. And everyone thinks that he was asking for their liberation. He was not. He was asking for them to have leave for a few days to go and worship God. He was asking for Pharaoh to recognize a fundamental freedom of religious liberty and a fundamental human dignity that at least a few days of their time as slaves should actually also be their own. And the amazing thing is that to be willing to ask for that was in some ways far more profound than to ask for their liberation, because that was the willingness to turn to Pharaoh and say, you know, you may want to see the world a little differently than you currently do. You may actually want to believe that, yes, they're your slaves, they'll keep being your slaves, but that slaves, even slaves, should have a little time of their own.
Yeah.
And yes, you may think you're a god, and that's all well and good, but you may want to consider the possibility that other people also have spiritual needs, and they don't want to worship you. They want to worship God. And you don't have to agree with them, but you might give them leave to do that, even for only a few days. And of course, that's the real work. Once we begin to consider the world differently than we have until a pivotal moment, once we make that shift, then everything can begin to change. And so let my people go is a plea for the kind of freedom of expression and the kind of human dignity that really is at stake in all of these struggles. We can have profound disagreements. We can have radical disagreements. Yeah. But we have got to find a way to appreciate that if there isn't freedom of conscience, if there isn't freedom of religious expression, if there, then actually, even the side we believe in is a side that is doomed.
Yeah, so profound, so powerful. You pointed out that this kind of hope is not about Pollyanna. It's not about rose-colored glasses. It's starting with some humility. It starts with that willingness to live a bit more boldly. To stand for that human dignity, that freedom. Rabbi Brad Hirschfeld, as always, thanks for enlightening us today. A very happy Passover to you. We look forward to having you back on the show real soon.
Thank you, sir. All the best.
All right. That's Brad Hirschfeld, from New York joining us as we roll into Passover this week. Some extraordinary thoughts. You're going to want to go back and listen to the podcast. I've been taking notes. I've got a lot to go back and think again about myself. We'll be right back.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Often in our country, when you hear the name Neville Chamberlain, many people don't know who Neville Chamberlain was. And those who do usually assume that it's a pejorative, that you're describing someone as who has either been deceived or naive or any of the above, or an accomplice to, or you can put all kinds of different things into there. And the interesting thing is a lot of that's been used just in the latest battle leading up to the vote over the weekend on funding for Ukraine. And Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, due to her opposition to that military aid to Ukraine, has been called a Neville Chamberlain. Now, really interesting, as we always do, you got to get past the headlines and you got to think again about what you think you know, even about someone like Neville Chamberlain. And someone who did just that for our friends at the Dispatch, Kevin Williamson, national correspondent for the Dispatch, had a brilliant piece late last week and joins us on the line. Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to talk to you.
So just walk us through this. I just found your writing on this so spot on and so instructive, because it's so beyond the headlines in terms of what we should be thinking as we approach some of these hard decisions in our country.
Yeah, well, you know, because we are for some reason governed by the dumbest people in the country, there was this sort of spat between Marjorie Taylor Greene and a Democratic congressman, which they were offering amendments to the Ukraine bill that were essentially trolling amendments. You know, she had this stupid thing of, well, if you vote for this, then you should be required to join the Ukrainian army. And the Democrat responded with a measure that would have renamed her office in Washington the Neville Chamberlain room. And the idea of this, of course, would be that he's trying to call her, you know, a stooge or a tool of a foreign power or something like that. And Neville Chamberlain's name gets used that way a lot, but that's not really who he was. And so for some reason, it has fallen to me to be the journalistic guardian of the name of Neville Chamberlain. So Chamberlain, just to start with, of course, I mean, you know, everyone who knows about Chamberlain knows about the Munich Conference and trying to make a deal with Hitler that would have kept Britain out of World War II. That was what he thought he was doing. And he came back and he waved a piece of paper around, said he'd achieved peace in our time. And this was obviously wrong. But Chamberlain wasn't, you know, some simpleton, and he wasn't some, you know, appeasing accommodationist either. He was a guy who had come to national politics relatively late in life. He was almost 50 when he was first elected to Parliament. There's no British prime minister that was ever older than that when he was first elected to Parliament. He'd been mayor of Birmingham before that and really been involved in municipal government. He was a kind of old-fashioned, you know, workhorse politician who did a lot of, you know, just really municipal-level good governance kind of stuff. He pretty quickly figured out that he had made a mistake. He owned up to his mistake. Mm. A lot of people forget that it was up to Neville Chamberlain, who was still the prime minister for the first several months of the war, to be the guy to go on the radio and tell the British people that, you know, we're now at war with Nazi Germany. And it's an interesting announcement if you go read it, because he's pretty honest about, you know, where he came from and what a bitter disappointment this was to him, how much he had sort of put on a line to try to keep peace, and it hadn't worked out. He was also, at this point, terribly, terribly sick. He had intestinal cancer, and he was in the last months of his life, and he continued working through, I guess, the end of September of 1940, and was dead by the second week of November.
Mm. Wow. And I think it's so interesting, and I love the way you described it in your piece of the Dispatch of, you know, what was it that he had shot for? And you even quoted Winston Churchill as he eulogized his formal rival in Parliament. Frame that for us.
Yeah, well, you know, Churchill was at times pretty savage on Chamberlain and his reputation, but he also kept him in his war cabinet, and he understood that he owed a certain political debt to Chamberlain as well. And, you know, what Churchill wrote about him and said in his eulogy was that, yes, he had been deceived and he had made a mistake, but he'd made it out of really the best of human motivations to try to keep his country out of what was sure to be a terrible and ruinous and horrifying war, which it was. You know, one of my favorite things about Chamberlain, you know, I'm an Eisenhower guy, and I sort of I admire people who don't get too carried away with titles and grandiosity in public life. And Neville Chamberlain's father had also been in national politics, but he was an industrialist. You know, so that got you branded as a kind of middle-class non-aristocrat. And so even though he had been a minister of government and all that, when he retired, he was not offered the, you know, kind of traditional retirement and the place in the House of Lords and all that stuff. And to which normally someone of his stature would have received, but he couldn't because of, you know, he didn't because of class reasons. So when Chamberlain was at the end of his life, Churchill, on behalf of the king, offered him the Order of the Garter, which is the highest civic award in England. And he turned it down and he said, "I prefer to die plain Mr. Chamberlain like my father before me." And I think that, you know, speaks well of what kind of man he was. He was not a, you know, self-aggrandizing kind of figure like our, you know, sort of modern troll politicians who are all seem to be, you know, auditioning for positions on cable news shows rather than trying to be the leaders of a self-governing free republic.
Yeah, no question about that. I love the last line there from Churchill when he talked about the pursuit of peace, even at great peril. Is such an important thing. As we close out, just in our last minute here, Kevin, give us a sense of what else we should be thinking about. Obviously, we have so many that are into the performative politics that are, you know, looking for that gig on the cable news or their latest clickbait. It was amazing over the weekend. Within seconds of the vote in the House, I got fundraising emails from a host of people in Congress. What is it that we need to change? What are some of the other things we should remember or learn from someone like Neville Chamberlain that could be very applicable to where we are today?
Well, I think one of the things to keep in mind is that there are good ways and bad ways to make mistakes. And sometimes people make mistakes trying to do the right thing, and sometimes people make mistakes out of bad motivations, out of fear or greed or selfishness or bad political calculation. And sometimes people make mistakes because they're trying to do big things that are beyond their powers. Mm. You know, I think a good example of that would be, I think most people in history 50, 100 years from now will probably come to the conclusion that the Iraq War was a mistake. But George W. Bush got into that, I think, with the best of motivations. He really thought that he could, in launching this campaign, transform the Middle East for the better and make the world in that way a much better place. There are mistakes that are made out of good motivations. They're still horrible mistakes with, you know, regrettable, unimprovable, unfixable consequences. And I think that's probably going to be one. But, you know, Dwight Eisenhower made a lot of mistakes, and George Washington made a lot of mistakes, and Abraham Lincoln made a lot of mistakes, but they made the right kinds of mistakes for the right reasons.
Yeah, that's so important, whether they're out of fear or greed or personal aggrandizement, all of those things can be part of that that problem there. Kevin Williamson, national correspondent for The Dispatch, great piece. Everyone should check that out at thedispatch.com. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. We'll step aside for a quick break. A lot of lessons in there in terms of how you make mistakes, why you make mistakes. Sometimes swinging big for peace leads to some mistakes. Sometimes the greed of your own agenda cause mistakes, and they're very different animals. We need to make sure we distinguish the difference. We'll be right back.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. As we look at the current Congress and how effective or ineffective it has been, most important, we have to look at what are they actually doing that's impacting the American people. I think the results don't lie. We're dealing with a lot of deep division, a lot of gridlock. And it's not that we always need to be doing more or passing more bills, but it's at least having the right conversations, the right debates, the right kinds of votes. And over the last decade, it seems to have gotten steadily worse in terms of productivity and efficiency in terms of Congress. And we want to take a look at that today from an interesting perspective. And I'm really thrilled to have joining us on the program, Nick Robertson, of course, is a staff writer for The Hill, has a great piece around Congress. And Nick, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you had a great piece today in The Hill, thehill.com, talking about the fact that, according to Joe Manchin, everyone should be ashamed of the current Congress. Is he right, and why?
Yeah, that's what Joe Manchin said. He and Rob Portman were talking about how there's a lot of dysfunction in the Senate and the House, and that's really slowing things down. We're seeing a big trend of members of Congress, both in the House and Senate, Manchin included, who are deciding to retire. because they just can't put up with it anymore. And as you noted, there haven't been many bills passed in Congress. This past year had the fewest bills ever passed the House of any recent term. And a lot of important legislation isn't really getting there.
Yeah, and that's in fact, let's chime in a little bit. This was a conversation with former Senator from Ohio, Rob Portman, and Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia with Manu Raju from CNN. Here's how former Senator Portman responded when asked if Congress is really fulfilling the job role. Here's how he described it.
Well, no, in the sense that Congress isn't doing much legislating, and they've been rather dysfunctional. The border policy, I think, has become sort of the poster child of what I'm talking about, that it's hard to solve policy issues these days because both the right and the left seem to get some advantage from things being unsolved.
So break that down for us just a little bit, Nick, especially as it relates to things like immigration, border security, that it seems that the political point is more important than the policy progress. How do we get past that?
Yeah, you're right that politics kind of wins out, especially in a big election season. Of course, every year is a big election season nowadays, it seems.
Yeah.
But the way you look at it, you know, Republicans and Democrats both want to fix the border. Of course, the way they want to go back about that is a bit different, but that's just down to brass tacks. So the idea with Republicans are saying, you know, we want to make X, Y changes. Democrats are saying a different thing, but they can't come to a compromise because if one side wins, then the other has to lose. And if that doesn't look good on the ballot box. So if nobody wins, nobody loses, and we don't change policy, that's where we're stuck.
Yeah. And I just want to pause on that for a second and unpack that, because I think it's important for our listeners to recognize that when the policy points are so high, then you get nothing done, but it maintains the status quo. And
right.
It seems to me that both sides of the political aisle are confident in their position with the status quo, that they can sell it, that they can raise money off of it, that they can run wedge issue campaigns off it. And so is it just the fact that politically both sides seem to think the status quo is okay and it may help us maintain or regain power?
Yeah, I think that's reasonable, that both sides are as much as they say this is the end of the world.
Right.
at the end of the day, the status quo is better than losing. No one
right.
wants to risk having the other side get a win out of it, even if it means making some reforms. What we saw earlier this year, and I think it was February, there was a bipartisan border package that was proposed in the Senate that had a lot of support, but the House didn't like it. Former President Trump didn't like it, and that got shut down. But a lot of the ideas there were very popular with most Americans, and that likely would have made a small progress towards a lot of the border stuff people are talking about. But because that would have made Democrats look good, because that didn't really work out.
Yeah, it's fascinating how that continues to be the marching orders from both sides of the political aisle. Don't risk anything that would cause us to risk losing the majority or prevent us from
right.
gaining the majority. And I think that's part of the problem there. As you talk with your sources there in D.C., Nick, any little coalitions building or anything kind of under the headlines in terms of things that we might see, or are we just kind of stuck in this fake fight and false choice until we get past the first Tuesday of November?
It's real tricky. You know, border is going to be the big thing this year. We did have that bipartisan package in February. Even getting it to the point that it did, that it got introduced in the Senate, was a major hurdle, even if it didn't make it to the House. And there have been rumblings that could maybe happen again. Though now with all of the foreign aid package for Ukraine, for Israel, that passed this past weekend, I'm not too sure if that's going to come up. We'll have to wait and see. So that's going to be the big question. But now we've been running on temporary federal budget bills for months and months now. People are moving on to the 2025 budget.
Yeah.
And then we're going to see a whole new round of fights over the there's no break.
Yeah, that's right. And we will just continue to make our prediction that September 30th will arrive this year, as it does every year. And my guess is with the election, we'll probably have a punting of the funding of the government until probably early December, where we'll have the fake fight and the false choice, and probably a continuing resolution, as you alluded to, Nick, that we'll probably see that play out one more time.
It would not surprise me.
Yeah. All right. Great great perspective, as always, Nick Robertson, staff writer for The Hill. You can check out his piece, Everyone Should Be Ashamed of Current Congress, by Joe Manchin there. And, Nick, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
All right. And that's Nick Robertson. And I think some of the things that Nick pointed out there that I think are really crucial for us to think through and to recognize as voters and as citizens, that the status quo is good for those who are in power. And whether you think that power is on the left or the right, in the Republicans or the Democrats, the status quo. And so often what we think are left and right battles are really vertical battles between those in power and those who aren't. Even within a singular party. In the Democrats, the biggest battles are not between the ideological spectrum, but between those who have power in the Democratic caucus and those who do not. And the same thing is true on the Republican side. You have those who are in power and in leadership and those who are not. And the answer to a lot of that comes in the kinds of bills that we saw over the weekend on these aid packages. The fact that they were very focused, very singular, so that members could actually read it, absorb it, debate it, and vote on it. And that's why you had some members of Congress who voted yes for Ukraine funding, but no for Israel funding. And some voted no for Israel and yes for Ukraine. And so you're allowed to do that, and that's the way it's supposed to be done. That's the way the process is supposed to work. And it's only when we get to those narrow bills, laser-focused. I'm one who believes we should get to singular subject kinds of bills rather than these massive bills that allow what I think should not be allowed, and that is the status quo. Because if you're interested in change, if you're interested in improvement for the country, if you're interested in real results to move the nation forward, the status quo won't cut it. But those in power love the status quo, so they're going to sell you division and dysfunction because it keeps them in power. So we've got to change the dynamic, but that starts with how we vote come November. All right, that wraps up hour number one of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We'll step aside for some top of the hour news. Hour number two is coming right up. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios. This is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, the headlines from the White House and from President Biden's campaign has been how good things are, especially in the economy. We've discussed often how the biggest challenge for the White House and for President Biden has been the disconnect between some of the good news and the good policy that he's passed and the reality of what everyday Americans are experiencing around their kitchen table. And that disconnect has been profound. We want to dig in a little bit deeper and think again about what we think we know about inflation and the economy and the impact it's having and the connection or disconnection with many of the political elites. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, as we've continued to cover, it's just really a challenging disconnect for the president because he wants to tout things that are good. The job numbers are good. The inflation is going down is good. And yet so many Americans are not feeling it. Someone who really dove into this in a powerful way, Michael Powell, is a staff writer for The Atlantic and wrote a piece called What the Upper Middle Class Left Doesn't Get About Inflation. And Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. My pleasure.
So let's start with just kind of the analysis and kind of your going about this and what the feel is versus what the reality or the disconnect is.
Yeah, I was struck that, you know, you hear so often from some leading lights within the Democratic Party, from some liberal economists that, well, you know, this inflation is largely tamed. Jobs are up, which is absolutely true. The economy is good, and that the problem for Americans who continually tell pollsters that they are feeling very precarious about their place is that, well, this is a vibe session. This is something, this is a kind of a psychological state, something they have to overcome and realize how good, you know, the economy is now. And what I did is I looked at not just the what is called the core inflation rate, but, you know, all the various inflationary costs, many of which are not counted in that inflation statistic. So, for instance, food inflation is up 20% over the last 3 or 4 years. High interest rates have had an inflationary impact, particularly for working class and lower middle class people. So mortgages are going up. New car loans are vastly more expensive because of high rates. Credit cards rates are up. So I looked at a whole series of these things, and frankly, in the end, it isn't a terrible surprise that a lot of Americans look at this economy, no doubt feel good that they're employed, but thinking, you know, I'm falling behind, you know, and I've been falling behind for a long time now.
Yeah, and I think that is so true. And it is the we always joke on the show about, you know, you have the core and you have the super core. And I think there's going to be one more after that where you take everything out and there is no inflation because there's nothing included, because we're not including housing or energy or food. As soon as we get rid of the rest of the things, we will have inflation under control.
Precisely. Right.
Well, talk to me a little bit about some of the things that you found looking at some of those elite economists who are saying, look, American people, this is just a bad vibe. You just got to get over it, get over yourself, so to speak, and come to grips with things are good.
Yeah, I mean, and I, you know, perhaps picked on, but I used to work at the New York Times, and Paul Krugman is a very good columnist there on the economy, but is prone to this, to my view, to this kind of, you know, what's wrong with you Americans? You know, you should realize really how good it is. And he talks about at one point going to the grocery store and, you know, buying things and it didn't seem more expensive to him. Maybe. but, you know, maybe if you're Paul Krugman. But I think for most Americans, and certainly, I mean, I think any of us can do this anecdotal thing, is just talk to, you know, friends who go shopping in the supermarket and see how much more expensive food is today than it was 3 or 4 years ago. This is, by the way, one need not blame, I don't know, you know, Biden for all of this, right?
Yeah, it's, for sure.
But it is to say that, like, there's always a problem, it strikes me, when you try to tell people that, you know, this is your reality, but it isn't really. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not really in trouble. This is just like some psychological state that you're in. And it just seems to me, you know, again, you look at energy prices. It's problematic.
Yeah, no question about that. And I think that's an interesting thing where this disconnect kind of keeps reverberating. Because they keep and I totally agree with you. I don't think this is I think the president, whatever party, gets way too much credit when it's good and way too much blame when it goes bad. But they are the president, so they got to own it. But talk to me for a second in terms of the conversation and how do we get past that? Because there's sort of the populist, the victimhood on one side. And then we've got some real things that we should tout, we should celebrate and have been good. But how do we get to that next step in all of this? Or are we just stuck in the just kind of the chase of it all, the campaigning component to it all?
Well, you know, and I think that's an important point because I think it's so hard. A lot of what happens in a campaign argues very strongly against being candid about anything, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, for instance, for Biden to go out, I mean, it's fair enough. You know, the job numbers are very good. Wages have gone up, albeit inflation is also going up. But he could point to that and then, I mean, in an ideal world, be able to say, look, we went through this terrible time. We had to do a lot of during COVID. We had to do a lot of spending. We got a bout of inflation. We're trying to bring it down. We know that's going to cause you some pain because, of course, it is. When interest rates go up, you know, the cost of all kinds of things, you know, home improvement loans. I mean, everything goes up. But again, the problem is that every politician, Republican or Democrat, you know, that runs against everything in that they've ever been taught. Don't, you know, concede nothing in an election year. And I think that's really it's presented a problem for the president right now.
Yeah, no question. And I think the elites on both sides of the aisle are part of the problem because they're so disconnected, I think, from where the rest of the country is and where a lot of hardworking Americans are in terms of that reality. This is a great piece. I've been so excited to have you on. I know you have got a tight window because you're going to be off covering what's happening at Columbia University.
Yes.
But Michael Powell, staff writer at The Atlantic, we really appreciate you squeezing this in today. Great piece. You can check it out at politico.com. And again, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, I appreciate it. It's been fun talking with you.
All right. And that's Michael Powell, staff writer at The Atlantic. The piece is, does the upper middle class understand inflation? And I think it is the big disconnect in both political parties that you have these elite who are telling the American people, you should feel this way, you should be happy for, you should be content with. And it's so disconnected from the reality. And I think that's part of the problem and why the growing distrust in government and in institutions. And the way we get back to that is to have a different kind of conversation. So we've got to think again about what we think we know and who's in charge and who actually does know best. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. Great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. As we continue to cover the very long saga of President Biden's different attempts to relieve Americans' massive amount of student debt, he's been taking some pretty big swings of late, campaign season and all. He hasn't always planned on how this would all come out or shake out in the end. And of course, he's had a few swatbacks from the Supreme Court. But he's continuing to lean into that as a strategy for a host of different reasons. And people are starting to wonder if any of these plans are really going to make it all the way through. And what kind of certainty or uncertainty does it create for the very people, those students holding student debt, are that he's promised to help? Jennifer Graham joins us. Of course, Jennifer is a journalist with more than 30 years experience. Love her writing, particularly for the Deseret News. And Jennifer, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. I appreciate you having me.
All right. So the president keeps swinging. It's like six ways to Sunday when it comes to student loan. Give us the lowdown on the most recent attempt and what that looks like. And is any of that ever really going to take effect?
You know, what it looks like he's doing is basic addition and trying to get back to the 40 million people that he was thinking he was going to help with his first proposal, which, as you noted, got struck down by the Supreme Court last year. So he has been coming back slowly and in kind of a piecemeal fashion over the past year, adding another 300,000 people here, another 277,000 borrowers here, and trying to get back up to that magic number of 40 million that he promised last year. And he's not there yet, but, you know, I think the administration now says that his plans would not eliminate, but mostly just have some reduction, and mostly in interest rates only, not principal, for about 30 million people, which in a cynical person might say 30 million voters, right?
Right.
Not 30 million people.
Right. And that has been the criticism. Is he leaning into this even harder because it's an election year and he needs particularly young voters who may be carrying a lot of that student debt? It's been interesting, too, in terms of looking at some of the latest things that the administration has said they're going to enact. Most of them wouldn't take place until either early or even July of 2025. If they stand at all, how does that all play out? And is that just adding to the cynicism out there?
Well, I mean, the cynicism is already so high, it'd be hard to make it worse, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, he's not helping his cause by having these news conferences where he's standing in front of a sign that says President Joe Biden is canceling your student debt. You know, it just if it's said paid for by the campaign of Joe Biden, you know, it couldn't be any more obvious. But in one of the most recent press releases, the administration says that some of the borrowers would begin getting notices this fall. Well, there's something else going on this fall, right? And so, yeah, I mean, it's, you might even say that the administration is perhaps not being completely truthful, because there's a very high risk. In fact, it's almost a certainty that all these new plans will be challenged as well. And they may well not result in anything other than getting people's hopes up long enough to go to the polls.
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting component to that. And as you break that down, and as you did in your piece at Deseret.com, a lot of this does create some uncertainty for those very people he says he wants to help, because some of them, some are immediately going out and spending money they don't have on the promise that they're going to get relief from their debt or their current status. How is this all shaking out, and what does that actually do when you say, well, okay, do I really, have I really been forgiven of that amount, or can I really take a break, and is there a penalty for that? It seems to me that often we end up hurting rather than helping with the uncertainty factor.
It does seem like that, because even the students who are, say, now enrolling as freshmen, with all of this talk about student loan forgiveness, and what seems to be, if you are a denizen of Twitter or X, you know, there seems to be this movement towards getting rid of this debt. I think in large cases, in many cases, there will be the perception that, well, my debt is going to get forgiven at some point. That if it's not now, it's going to be the next administration, but it's going to get taken care of, and I don't need to worry about it. And I can take out a $90,000 loan to go to the school I want to go to this fall. And that's significant, too, that it has been reporting over the past 6 weeks or so that that's a historic high. Yeah. At some of the priciest Ivy League universities now, $90,000 a year.
Wow. Yeah, that's stunning. And that was one of the other things that I noted from your piece, was just the cost of higher ed continues to skyrocket, a disproportion to all of the other things, inflation and otherwise, that seems to be going up. And so to me, that seems to be kind of a counterswing in terms of what is happening. And are we, with all of this forgiveness and all of this, are we actually just creating a path for even higher costs? And then what does that do for those who can't get that aid or can't get those kinds of loans?
And that really is the most sensible argument to my mind among people who are arguing against this plan, for the most part, conservatives, of course. And there is the conversation about the national debt, of course. And, you know, can we really just keep spending, you know, like this without thinking about the consequences? But yeah, even the administration pointed out in its language on the Department of Education website that since 1980, the cost of higher education has tripled, not counting for inflation. And what has happened, there is all this quote unquote financial aid available, which is a term that just personally, it makes me kind of nuts, because I mean, it makes it sound like we are just giving out money and we're not. I mean, that financial aid is, you know, it does include some grant money, but for the most part, they're talking about loans that will have to be repaid. And they're also talking about students working at school, which, you know, I guess Dave Ramsey will say, yeah, they should work at school. But, yeah, you know, we can argue about that. That's a whole different story. But yeah, I mean, that's the main and most reasonable argument about this, is because these aid packages are available, that's why colleges and universities can charge this amount of money. Yeah. If kids didn't have access to these loans, I don't know how many people would be going to college.
Yeah. And you pointed this out from the Department of Education, that that things like Pell Grants once covered 80% of the cost of a four-year degree, but now it's barely a third. Of that
correct.
Cost.
And that's not that Pell Grants have gone down.
Right.
It's that the tuition is so high that it doesn't approach the cost.
Yeah. You concluded by talking about this as a risky strategy for President Biden. And obviously he's dealing with some struggles because of what's happening on the foreign policy front, especially with young voters. Is this just one more big swing? And will this be a big swing and a hit for the president, or will there be a backlash?
Well, we will see, right? I mean, if he does manage, in the very unlikely scenario that he is able to offer some student aid, student relief this fall, there that might translate into some votes at the poll. Interestingly enough, I went and looked back about what happened when there was controversy over Trump signing his name on the COVID checks, if you remember that. The people were all upset and saying, well, that was a just kind of a blatant attempt to buy votes by putting his name on those checks. And the Washington Post went back and did an examination on what happens when names are attached to policies like that. And it's very unclear whether it actually plays out or not. And the problem Biden has right now, of course, is he's got all these anger from young people about his foreign policy, which they don't agree with by and large. And, you know, whether a promise of a student loan write-off or just small reduction is going to overcome that anger, I don't know. I just don't see it.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Great writing, great thinking, which is where it always begins with Jennifer Graham. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us today. Great piece.
Thank you. Thank you. It's an important topic. Appreciate you talking about it.
All right. Okay. Fantastic. And that's Jennifer Graham. A great piece. You can check it out at Deseret.com talking about President Biden's student loan plan. And is it a risky swing? Is it reality? What will the impact be? Will there be any backlash? All things that you got to consider when we talk about higher education. We'll step aside for some bottom of the hour news. More Inside Sources coming up next. Stick around.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, we've often talked about on this show how it isn't that hard to incite a populist uprising on just about any issue of the day. A four-year-old can do that. It's really not that difficult because the populist message it's pretty easy. Populism only has to incite the riot. It doesn't have to govern, doesn't have to lead, doesn't have to do any of those things. And the challenge is we've allowed that to seep further and further into our culture and further into our distrust of institution. And it's really created a framing that makes it very difficult to move the country, to move the economy forward. A fantastic piece at Deseret.com by Michael Kofed. Talking about this very issue of populism enabling and empowering this negative sum thinking. Michael's an assistant professor of economics at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville, research fellow at the Institute of Labor and Economics. And we will give a Go Wildcats shout out. He is a graduate from Weber State University as well as the University of Georgia. And Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Boyd, for having me on. It's fun to be on my hometown radio.
Yeah, it's always good to pull the hometown talent back. And you wrote a brilliant piece at Deseret.com talking about this whole idea of populism and where it has actually led us, particularly as it relates to the economy. Explain that for us.
Yeah, you bet. And so whenever we're teaching a principles of economics class here at almost any university, it starts out that when we have free markets and free enterprise, that transactions are inherently positive sum or win-win. I only buy a product if I derive more value for it than the price I pay, and sellers will only sell to me if they can net a price greater than their own costs. And so this is kind of the foundation of economic thinking, is how can transactions, relationships, and human interactions generate more welfare for everyone that is involved. However, as we can also see, it derives down, sometimes we see in our society, zero-sum thinking, which is the idea that for me to gain, someone else has to lose. But what we see right now with the kind of streak of populism in our political society is that I actually am interested in not only gains anymore, but making sure that my opponent loses more than I'm going to lose.
Yeah.
And so this kind of becomes a punching match where essentially I'm happy to cut my nose off to spite my face as long as I can hurt the other person in this transaction.
Yeah, and it becomes all part of that grievance mentality too. It's a whole lot of the us and them thing that has just been percolating throughout the country and really around the world. It's not just the U.S. and the U.S. economy. We've been seeing this in governments around the world. You pointed out in your piece this very thing that throughout history, a lot of nations and economies have faltered because they get stuck in that zero-sum trap.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you think of this about conflict, before I was at Tennessee, I taught at West Point and I taught national security economics. And, you know, war and battle and conflict is harmful because everyone essentially loses at the end. And so what we are trying to do is hopefully through our market society, encourage human thriving by increasing the win-win opportunities. One of the things I think is so ironic is that Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations that really pointed out this need for cooperation in 1776, which is the exact same year the Declaration of Independence was signed. And so the founders kind of borrowed his ideas about how can we work together as opposed to against each other to have a more prosperous union.
Yeah, and being able to get back to that, I think, is such a crucial thing, especially at this juncture, I think, that we find our nation and the world in, that if we continue down that zero sum, and as you described it, it's even zero sum worse, because it's not enough to be zero sum. I got to make sure there's a price to pay or something to exact from my opponent to make their life worse, not just zero sum. How do we change that dynamic, and how do we start to move that forward, both on a community level and then nationally and internationally?
Sure. I think the first important is helping recognize other people, even if they look different than me or they have a different political philosophy as me, as, you know, inherently human beings that we can learn from and that we can work with. We're not always going to agree on everything, but if we push each other to try to figure out how both sides can be more happy, I think that's a huge step forward. I think also as we realize that most human beings actually want what's best for their communities and what's best for their families, it makes it really hard to hate the other person. And this is kind of what we can also see in our economic models. In areas where there's higher amount of social capital and social trust, there's greater intergenerational mobility. Some work by my colleagues, Raj Chetty, for example, shows that Salt Lake City metro area has the highest amount of intergenerational mobility because it also has the highest amount of social trust. And so I think as we can see each other as human beings and the dignity that that comes with, that then it'll be easier for us to try to reach a win-win.
That social capital is so important, and I always go back to Abraham Lincoln, who was an authentic leader, who recognized that we have to get past the zero sum, and he even described the role, the purpose of government being to elevate the condition of man, to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, to clear the path of laudable pursuits for all, to afford all an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life. And a lot of that is through connection. Lincoln did it through building waterways and roads and things to connect people, not just to economics, but to other people, so that that social capital could really begin to grow.
That's right. That's right. I mean, one of the fascinating things Lincoln also did for local is he was the first one to authorize the Transcontinental Railroad and how that connected people and had a huge part to do with Utah's history as well.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things I love about Adam Smith is, we talk about his book, Wealth of Nations, but he has another book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, where he says man naturally desires to not be loved, but also be lovely or something that someone would actually want to love. And so that's kind of how we as human beings do, is we want to be part of that society that will allow us to boost human thriving.
Yeah. And so give me one thing as we close out. Give me the therefore what component to all of this. What should we be thinking differently? What should we be doing differently to get to that win-win and to actually move forward together?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest steps is when we hear someone tell us that, you know, we are the victim, we can't choose for ourselves, but rather we can think to ourselves, I have agency, I have the ability to see my neighbor as a human being, and that as we work together, we can do great things as our community.
Fantastic. It's a great piece. You should check that out at Deseret.com. Again, Michael Kofed, Assistant Professor of Economics at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, Research Fellow at the Institute of Labor Economics, and, of course, a former Wildcat. So we add that to the bonus list today because that's the ultimate win-win. Mike, thanks so much for joining us. Fantastic piece, great thinking, great writing. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Boyd. Go Wildcats.
All right, there you go. Mike Kofed. Great perspective there. And it is one of the things that I worry about regularly is this populism that's sort of unhinged from principle and good policy is detrimental to where we're trying to go as a society. And so we have to figure out where not the zero sum thinking, but that win-win, that value add, where can I make a difference? Where can I add value? where can I be part of the social capital that will help everyone, especially those that are struggling, have that opportunity for upward mobility and human dignity and really human flourishing. So lots to think about there. Great piece there. We'll go ahead and step aside for one last break. We'll come back with some final thoughts on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. As we round out the program today, I want to stay with the conversation just a little bit from our last segment where we talked with Michael Kofed about this whole populism thing and this whole zero-sum game and everything that it's doing that is not only creating division in the country, it's preventing us from actually solving the problems and moving forward in the country. And while everybody wants to say, hey, I'm the one looking out for the little guy, and everybody's doing it, it is the political strategy of the day, is just have a populist message. And I'm one of those who believes that if you populism, fine, but you got to have it based and connected to some foundational principles. Otherwise, everybody's just giving everything away for whoever they're trying to court at the moment, and it never ends well. History has shown us that. But I believe that populism will continue to be a powerful, misused, and I would say abused political tool as long as the current leaders and the current policymakers, again, left and right, across the political spectrum, are primarily concerned with preserving their own power and the status quo. We talked about that throughout the show today, that as long as you're trying to maintain the status quo, that gets pretty easy. Because you just have a populist message, you say the country's too divided, we can't solve big issues anymore, and the status quo remains. And the people in power, the very ones who are claiming they're watching out for the little guy, are only watching out for themselves. And that's the problem in the current system. So you have the cry to take on the wealthy and the well-connected echo from the liberal left. You got chants against the establishment and the elite from the right. And the real question that I ask is anyone actually looking out for the little guy? A lot of people like to claim it. But as we say in my house, if you have to declare it, you're probably not it. So is there an authentic version of populism? I don't know. We are far afield from it, to be sure. As I've said before, it's not hard to incite a populist uprising on just about any issue. A four-year-old can do it, literally. A number of years ago, my daughter and her husband were driving a very long drive from California back to Arizona. And buckled in the back seat, they had their two boys who were ages 4 and 2. And the boys did a pretty good job of enduring a very long, long ride. And as they do that, they try to be efficient and effective. So my daughter sometimes would extend their car rides, and they would instigate what they called the no water periods. In other words, no drinks for the boys so that they didn't have to stop every 20 minutes for a needed potty break. So apparently there was no such water consumption restriction for the parents in the front seat. It only applied to those sitting in the back seat. And that is where the populist uprising of the backseat began. So the older grandson was trying to rile up the backseat to complain against this incredible injustice that they couldn't have a drink, but their parents could in the front seat. So in this case, he played both the leader of the crowd and the chanter, and it was an interesting back and forth. The older grandson would begin with the chant, "Is everyone in the car thirsty?" And then, of course, they would echo, "Everyone is thirsty. Who wants water? Everyone. Is everyone in the front thirsty? Yes. Is everyone in the back thirsty? Yes. Is the front allowed to drink? Yes. Is the back allowed to drink? No." And the backseat populist movement against the tyranny of the parents in the front began. Now, my grandson could lay claim to leadership of the back of the car while protesting the oppression of the them, they, those, other people sitting in the front of the car. I could actually envision these boys reenacting a scene from Les Mis. I'm sure they were all ready to, you know, come together as they were going to take on the front of the car. But that's often where populist uprisings end. If the little boys in the backseat did do a hostile takeover of the front, they'd probably crash the car. And the problem with political populism is that at its core, it's divisive. It creates an us versus them. And those kind of battles result in the shouts of what people are against instead of a conversation about a vision for what they're for. It also spends an inordinate amount of time demonizing the them, the they, those people, instead of seeking to find the problem. Now, we've watched this for over a decade now. The Tea Party populism of 2009 used angst and anger and frustration around Obamacare as the piston to drive a white-hot engine of change against the them of President Obama and congressional Democrats. The flip side of that, the Occupy Wall Street movement, similarly channeled frustration about the top 1% of earners, millionaires, corporate executives, as the populist target for people angry about the economy to rail against. Of course, President Trump rode a very populist wave into office in 2016. Things swung back around in 2020. So the populist message is not hard for any candidate to claim, because the American people do want to be led, and they do want to feel like they have a leader that has their back and is actually fighting for them. So part of the problem of all of this dueling populism from the left and the right is that the American people have become increasingly convinced that the system's rigged. They've watched their political leaders, lobbyists, wealthy donors, well-connected elites climb the ladder of success and then basically pull the ladder up behind them. As I've said before, populism only has to incite the riot. Populism doesn't have to govern or provide real solutions to real problems. And I believe the solution to this only comes in the form of authentic leaders who recognize what their role is, what the role of government is, and what it will take to do that. And it usually begins with a leader who's willing to say, I will do what is right even if it costs me my job. Even if I lose the next election, I'm going to do the right thing because I am looking out for the little guy and for the future of the nation. Well, that wraps it up for us on Inside Sources today here on KSL News Radio. I'm Boyd Matheson. Thanks for joining us. And as always, as you go out into the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.